This audio recording is protected under U.S. copyright laws. It is produced by Nichols Patrick CPE and provided by your state society of CPAs for your personal non-commercial use. Further reproduction, distribution, or commercial use of this recording without written permission from Nichols Patrick is prohibited. Requests for permission to reproduce this material should be addressed to Nichols Patrick CPE, Suite A, 973 West Liberty Street, Hubbard, Ohio, 44425. Welcome to the Weekly Tax Update for May 28, 2013. We have 9 items this week that attracted my attention. The first, a technical advice memorandum in connection with an audit of a fraternal society in which the IRS National Office takes the position that the sale of insurance policies to non-member spouses produces unrelated business income. Next, another speech by Karen Hawkins, this one in which she says that the OPR does not intend to provide any examples of what professional competence is under the newly proposed Section 10.35 of Circular 230 because the AICPA and the American Bar Association already have rules relating to professional competence. And then an unusual letter ruling holding that the termination of an S-corporation election was inadvertent. Now, that in itself is not unusual, but this particular S-corporation had passive investment income in excess of 25% of its gross receipts for 4 years and had to work out an arrangement with the Internal Revenue Service, which allowed it to keep its S-corporation status. And then the long-running saga of Alan Davis down in the 11th Circuit has concluded with a ruling from the 11th Circuit that $36 million worth of stock, which he received pursuant to an option, was in fact related to his performance of services for a corporation in which he owned a 23% interest and therefore should have been reported as taxable income. That's a big hit, $36 million to your income. Next, a broadcaster's promotional service fees were, at least they thought they were properly handled by his employer, in that the service fees were collected by the employer and then paid and reported on a W-2. Turns out he was really an independent contractor, so in this particular case, no matter how hard you try, you can't do it right. The Third Circuit has revisited the Majestic Star Casino decision that we reported to you on here about 18 months ago, in which the Circuit Court says that the Q-sub status of an insolvent Q-sub is not a tax attribute of the Q-sub, but is rather a property interest of its corporate parent that was not insolvent, and therefore the corporate parent could revoke the Q-sub status to the detriment, by the way, of the general creditors. Then an observation here, an article by Amy Elliott that appeared in Tax Notes today reporting a speech in which an IRS official explained they're having trouble deciding how to resolve an unintentional glitch in the proposed Section 1411 net investment income tax regulations, set to 3.8% Medicare tax. It seems that the regulations as they're written would require you to include in your income subject to the 3.8% tax your gross gains, but would not allow you to offset losses of the same type and kind. So the IRS is trying to figure out how to fix that. Then we have a very interesting long-running case on an individual's liability for a trust fund recovery penalty. The citation is Joel Beeler. It's a tax court memo decision. Here, the tax court got the case back from the Second Circuit. This episode began in 1986 with the IRS assessing a trust fund recovery penalty against 3 responsible persons of a corporation that didn't pay its payroll taxes and then went out of business. One of those persons paid nothing ever. The other went through bankruptcy, and there was a payment to the IRS of some $86,000 in connection with the bankruptcy, and the IRS so mishandled the account, the record, the transcript. There were entries in the transcript that made no sense. There were entries in this transcript for amounts that were never involved in the matter. Mr. Beeler continued his appeals for a long time. We'll talk about how that finally came out. And then finally, another article by our friend Amy Elliott at Tax Notes today on proposed regulations being developed by the IRS to deal with disguised sales. So let's begin. In TAM 2013-20023, the IRS concludes that a fraternal society's sale of life insurance policies to non-member widows of deceased insured members, under which the widow can name as a beneficiary anyone including someone other than a dependent of the member, is not substantially related to the entity's exempt fraternal purpose. That's pretty straightforward. Membership was limited to men, and it was limited to men of a particular faith. The parent entity and its subordinate chapters have a group exemption under 501c8. This TAM, 8 pages long, is a great analysis and history of fraternal societies, why they were organized, why they have the possibility of tax-exempt status, and the original provisions under which these societies provided insurance, and their original mutual aid activities, and how that is different from selling insurance to the widows of members who can name other family members who are not necessarily even dependents of the deceased man of the particular faith, and that takes it into the area of selling commercial insurance. Our next item is an article, written by Jeremiah Coder on a speech by Karen Hawkins to the AICPA Tax Controversy Conference in Las Vegas in mid-May. Ms. Hawkins said she was appalled at the notion of an IRS agent using the threat of referral of a practitioner to the OPR or assertion of prepare penalties as a bargaining tool during an examination. And by the way, that is directly opposite to official IRS policy. Any agent who did that should be immediately reported to the agent's supervisor. That practice, according to the report, according to Ms. Hawkins, creates an inherent conflict of interest for the taxpayer's representative and should not happen. According to Ms. Hawkins, it's highly inappropriate for the agency, the IRS, to be the source of a conflict of interest that may force a practitioner to withdraw from the representation. Ms. Hawkins went on in this speech to warn against firms charging a contingent fee for conducting a research credit study, asserting that they are essentially playing the audit lottery. She doesn't see a lot of quality in most research credit studies, and she also cautioned against the receipt or against taking fees, against the CPA practitioner accepting a fee from the credit study firm for the referral. That is an inherent conflict of interest, and according to Ms. Hawkins, the OPR will find a way, this is a quote, will find a way to use Circular 230 discipline in those situations. So there you have it. That's the latest from the director of the OPR, who, by the way, has decided to stay on. She was going to leave when Director Shulman left, but that didn't happen. She's enjoying her job, which is not necessarily good news. Next, we have an S corporation that had excess net passive investment income for 3 years, a period during which it also had C corporation earnings and profits. They discovered this in year 4, came clean, went to the IRS, explained the whole situation, and here is the deal they made. For years 1, 2, no change. For they paid the tax. So in years 1, 2, and 3, they paid the tax. The S corporation shareholders reported their income as S corporation shareholders. In year 4, they filed a return as an S corporation, sent K-1s to the shareholders, did not discover that they in fact should have lost their S corporation election as of the end of year 3. So now they're asking to please retain their S corporation status. Letter ruling 2013-20008 offers the taxpayer this deal. They must file an amended return for 2004, electing a deemed dividend within 120 days of the letter ruling. That will, of course, create taxable income for the S corporation shareholders. Next, they must pay tax on their investment income reported in year 4 at the corporate level within 45 days of receiving the letter. And finally, the shareholders must file amended returns within 120 days. So this takes us to Code Section 1362F4. And 1362F4 says that the IRS has the authority to grant deals like this, and they can impose conditions. So that the authority of the IRS is very broad here, but not only do they have the authority to grant an exemption or an exception to what would otherwise be an automatic termination of your S corporation status, they have the authority to impose conditions, and they imposed conditions here which seem appropriate to the circumstances. The bad thing about that particular letter ruling and about all of these S corporation rulings where the S corporation is granted permission to keep its S status is they do not recite the facts. The rulings simply say, based on the facts submitted, and they're unique, of course, we rule as follows. Next, we have Alan Davis. This matter's been going on for at least a decade. Alan Davis may still be a 23% shareholder in a payday loan company that headquartered in Florida. The other shareholders included a daughter and two sons. This is a multi-million dollar issue. The taxpayers thought it was a $16 million issue. The tax court revalued that to $36 million and ruled that it should have all been included in ordinary income. A brief summary of the facts. Mr. Davis owned 23% of the S Corp. His children owned the rest, but he was a guarantor of 100% of multi-million dollars of debt. He lost one half of his stock to his wife in a divorce. So he's going to wind up, instead of owning 23%, he's only going to own half of that. But he did not want to dilute his ownership. So he wanted to have at least an opportunity to maintain his ownership interest. So in the transfer of the stock to his wife, and this opinion took 10 pages to write, so it's fairly complex. In the transfer of the stock to his wife, at the same time he transferred the stock, the corporation gave him an option to purchase as the same amount of stock that he had transferred to his wife. So he's not going to lose any percentage of his interest, but he is going to have to exercise this option. The corporation then entered into an agreement to repurchase the stock that had been transferred to the spouse. She never intended to keep the $16 million worth of stock anyway. So she tenders her stock, the corporation buys her stock, and then transfers it to Mr. Davis pursuant to an option that was granted at relatively low strike price. And there's a cashless exercise and a bunch of other complexities. But the bottom line is the question of how to value the stock. Mr. Davis argues that the stock was not transferred to him in connection with the performance of services because it was transferred to him as a result of an assignment from the former wife. He even argues that Code Section 1045 protects him from any income. This is where it gets interesting. Mr. Davis transferred stock to his former wife, Judith, and she transferred an option to him pursuant to their divorce settlement. Well, at that time, neither had to recognize any gain or loss because Section 1041 covered the transaction and property transferred incident to a divorce. Nobody recognizes any gain. However, once the transfer was complete, 1041 no longer applied. The transfer of an option is distinct from its exercise. So Mr. Davis was trying to get the tax court to extend the protection of 1041 to his exercise of the option that was transferred to him in connection with his divorce, but Section 1041 does not apply to the disposition of assets received in connection with a divorce settlement. So Mr. Allen winds up with a taxable exercise of his option, not for $16 million, but for $36 million, based on an appraisal secured by the Internal Revenue Service and preferred by the court. Next, we have Tax Court Summary Opinion 2013-38. Oh, wait a second. Let me give you the citation on Davis. That's an 11th Circuit decision, citation number 12-10916, reported May 16, 2013. And by the way, all of these citations are in a separate Word document, which you should be able to access from the same source that you got this audio file. Next, Juan Ramirez, Tax Court Summary Opinion 2013-38. Mr. Ramirez was a radio personality down in South Texas. He got a salary from the radio station, and he went out and promoted sponsorships. So he had about $90,000 of sponsorship, $82,000 of sponsorship income that he went out and generated himself in addition to the salary that he got from the radio station. The sponsors paid the fees to the station. The station included the fees in Mr. Ramirez's W-2 and subjected everything to payroll taxes. The glitch came when Mr. Ramirez deducted $26,000 and change in trade or business expenses in connection with his trade or business of being a radio personality, which was clearly distinct from his employment by the radio station. The final resolution of this matter turns out that the IRS contends and the tax court agrees that Mr. Ramirez and the radio station must refigure his W-2. They got to take the $82,000 out. He reports the $82,000 on his Schedule C. He's permitted to deduct the $26,000 of related Schedule C business expenses, and they have to recalculate everything because now you've got withholding paid in, which creates credits, which may or may not be the same amount as the self-employment tax, although it should be close. In any event, it's a fascinating read if you are concerned about how to handle situations where the employer collects money which is specifically attributable to work done by the employee in their capacity other than as an employee, and they simply act as a conduit, paying the money out to the employee and including that in a W-2. It doesn't come up very often, but it certainly is a twist on the old worker versus independent contractor controversy. Our sixth item this week is Majestic Star Casino versus Barden Development, a decision of the Third Circuit Court of Appeals. Here, the Third Circuit vacates a bankruptcy court decision, holding that a debtor company did not have a property interest in its status as a qualified Subchapter S subsidiary. Its Sub S parent had a property interest in its subsidiary, but the parent was not in bankruptcy. The parent was solvent. The insolvent subsidiary had no property interest in its S corporation status, and its solvent parent was free to terminate its S election at will, and of course it did so. So the Q sub lacks standing to challenge the loss of its Q sub status, and the trustee cannot get any standing greater than the standing of the bankrupt corporation. The Third Circuit observes this is an issue of first impression for any federal circuit court. That makes it pretty important. Q sub status is not property within the meaning of the Internal Revenue Code. Even if it were to find that Q sub status is property, it still would not belong to the bankruptcy estate. If Q sub status is property at all, it's the property of the parent. The bankruptcy court's determination would restrict the rights of the parent corporation to engage in transactions that could result in termination of S corporation status. Since the tax status is not property that belongs to the bankrupt debtor, then the conditions for third-party standing, which would allow the trustee to litigate on the debtor's behalf, are not met. Next, we've got a little commentary here on the difficulty of imposing New Code Section 1411 and the proposed regulations the IRS has issued. In the proposed regulations, the IRS classifies income into three categories or three levels. Category 1 is gross income from interest, dividends, annuities, royalties, and rents not derived from passive activities or trading in financial instruments or commodities. Category 2 is other gross income that is derived from passive activities or trading in financial instruments or commodities. Category 3 is net gain attributable to the disposition of property that is not held in a trade or business that's not a passive activity or trading in financial instruments or commodities. So you can quickly see that a loss could get trapped in Category 3, while the income from the same kind of transactions would be reportable and taxable in Category 2. The concern at the IRS is if Congress meant to say net gain or loss, then they should have said that. But when it says net gain, it means the number cannot go below zero. And if the number cannot go below zero, then you've got those losses that are trapped in Category 3. Implementation of New Code Section 1411 is causing a great deal of difficulty for a lot of practitioners. The compliance costs are going to become significant if the IRS does not produce reasonable regulations, because we're all going to be struggling to determine whether property is held in a trade or business or trading is made at the entity or fund level. Suppose I invest in a hedge fund, and the hedge fund invests in another fund, which invests in another fund, and that third fund level down is engaged in trading commodities, and they're reporting their income and losses upstream. When I finally get them into my return, how in the world am I supposed to assure that I'm properly complying and identifying my Section 1411 Medicare taxable income correctly? It's going to be a mess And we need the guidance now. We don't need the guidance next February. Our next item is Joel Beeler, Tax Court Memo Decision 2013-130. This is on remand from the Second Circuit. The tax court has sustained the IRS's proposed collection action against Mr. Beeler, but for an amount reduced by an $82,000 credit for payment made by another party who was also held to be a responsible person. The tax court got this wrong in the first place. The Second Circuit sent it back to the tax court. The litigation, the collection efforts, everything started back in 1986. So this has been just a horrible nightmare for Mr. Beeler. Among other things, the IRS really mishandled the account. They didn't keep proper records. They made erroneous entries in the transcript. And given the current status of the public's relationship and concerns about the IRS, I think you'll find this paragraph very interesting. I'm going to read this paragraph. I don't do this very often, but I want to read this paragraph from the opinion of the Court of Appeals when they sent this back to the tax court. Although we resolved this appeal in the manner discussed above, which was to send it back, we express concern over the Internal Revenue Service's conduct, including its admittedly erroneous filing of the Certificate of Release of Federal Tax Lien, its use of language in the Certificates of Release of Federal Tax Lien certifying that Beeler satisfied the taxes listed below and all statutory additions, and by the way, just parenthetically, thereby creating the impression in Beeler's mind that he didn't owe any more money, right? 3, its subsequent notice to Beeler of its intent to levy his property 5 years after releasing the liens. 4, adopting a policy in the Internal Revenue Manual which facially contradicted a code section. The general failure at maintaining accurate records concerning what taxes were owed and what payments were made by Beeler, at least as presented in the appellate record. 6, erroneously making entries in the account transcripts of Equidyne's other officers, that Equidyne was the company that went out of business, that indicated the statute of limitations on collection of judgments against them had expired when it had not. We do not address, the court says, whether this conduct has any legal impact on Beeler's underlying tax liability and write only to express our concern over the IRS's handling of this matter. Now, I'm producing this program at a time when the IRS is drawing heavy fire for its treatment of 501c4 applications from conservative political groups. There's also a class action lawsuit out in California for the IRS's heavy-handed handling of a search warrant in which they erroneously, wrongfully, illegally took medical records. As these things bubble up, the IRS comes under fire. It really is in our best interest that the IRS have the respect of the public, because if the public doesn't respect the Internal Revenue Service, then they don't really respect the service that we provide. Finally, this week, just a heads up that the IRS is developing proposed regulations under Section 707A2B and Section 752. That are going to modify the disguised sale rules and address the so-called bottom dollar guarantees. And in that connection, they're now considering some transition rules that they would publish, get those out quickly, while they complete the balance of the proposed regulations. The guidance is intended to ensure that transactions are appropriate and fair, while also providing appropriate transitional rules so that taxpayers who may already be engaged in transactions that rely on the current regulations, which were, by the way, released back in 1991, are treated fairly. So if you're in a deal and you're concerned about whether or not you can rely on the 1991 regulations, the chances are that you can, even though new regulations are imminent. Well, the program was late this week. It's also long this week. Thank you so much for your patience and for your collegial meetings with me every week. I enjoy it. Meanwhile, stay safe.